Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And I'm so glad, Dr. Gwyther, that you're able to fill in as a co-host on the research that matters in our house calls today for Christy Page. Welcome to the show.
And it's my pleasure to come back.
You know, we are going to be talking or listening to a conversation that Dr. Page had recently with Julia Allen, two-time heart attack survivor and spokesman for the American Heart Association, about surviving heart attacks. But first, Bob, we've got some really interesting research that matters about oatmeal and what that may have an impact on life, about aspirin and who should be on it and who shouldn't, about vaping, and even about multiple sclerosis. Pretty exciting research.
Yeah, and pretty relevant to heart disease too.
Yeah, let's talk about our very first research that matters, this study about a bowl of oatmeal a day. Can it really keep the doctor away?
No, but it may be able to keep heart attacks and cardiovascular disease away. It doesn't do very much for malignancy, but it does for cardiovascular disease, probably because it reduces cholesterol.
Yeah, this was some research that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association's journal, Internal Medicine, and it was a research out of Harvard where they followed 100,000 people for 14 years and really looked at what they were eating and how they lived and kind of see what happened to them. And it found out those who ate 33 grams of whole grains a day, which is about a bowl of oatmeal, they cut their risk of premature death by 9% compared to those who didn't eat any of these grains.
That's pretty impressive, actually.
It is.
I might add that weight loss is also a good thing, in that while this is a great whole grain and that's probably got something to do with why it works, you got to be careful with having six bowls of oatmeal in order to try to reduce your heart disease, because it'll put some weight on you, seriously.
Right. If one was good, was two better? And in this case, actually, for each 28-gram increase in whole grains per day, it did lead to greater protection. But lower amounts didn't seem to have much protection. So maybe there's a threshold. And I think you're absolutely right, Bob. If you eat too much, you'll perhaps negate the benefit. But some is probably very good.
And if you're a diabetic, once again, whole grains are probably better than processed carbs. But you got to watch your total carb intake, too.
Speaking of things that we have to watch, our next research that matters is, I think, one that's important for really all of your health listeners. And that's about aspirin use and daily aspirin use to really, particularly after one's had a heart attack. But this particular research question was about a different topic, which is some of the aspirin use potentially inappropriate?
Yeah, and it's predicated on this. We know that there's a therapeutically beneficial effect of aspirin to keep platelets from sticking together and therefore decrease clotting. And it seems that plugged up arteries in the heart or the brain benefit from that. On the other hand, it can also cause bleeding in the gut, rarely anaphylaxis. I mean, there are downsides to taking aspirin. So what these guys are trying to figure out is, well, does the risk outweigh the benefit for whom?
Right. And so this particular study, which was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, followed close to 69,000 U.S. adults for a period of time and looked at, you know, by the algorithms from the guidelines, the American College of Cardiology, the other authorities, what percentage of these people perhaps were taking it for the reasons that are not necessarily indicated, which is the prevention of heart disease if you've never had a heart attack? And perhaps would there be a certain number who maybe should be talking to their doctor about whether or not they would benefit versus has this risk, as you mentioned, perhaps of bleeding or ulcers?
So the design of the study is, if we know it's a risk factor and it's going to help, then we'll say, okay, doing it. And everything else, we didn't say, so it's wrong. Well, that seems a little overstated to me. But they did find that the people who took it appropriately got a usual benefit from it, and the others probably didn't have the rare events very often.
Yeah, and I must say I'm a little bit of a worry wart, because you sometimes don't see the benefits necessarily, but you see the side effects. So I've seen lots of people who've had bleeding episodes with aspirin, but let's not discount the fact that aspirin is a really powerful drug. Even at an 81 milligram, that baby aspirin dose a couple times a week, it can still cause bleeding. But if you have had a heart attack, it definitely benefits. If you haven't, you probably should talk with your doctor and let them do a calculation to see if you would benefit. And they estimate that benefit is if you have a 6% chance of having a heart attack or a stroke over the next decade, you would probably benefit from aspirin. Interesting research.
And I also calls for, well, who? How old are you? What's your sex? What's your health history? Because a lot of people my age, 70 and over, ought to take it simply because our risk is that high of having a heart attack.
You look much younger, Bob.
Oh, yeah, but
let's talk about our next research that matters, which is about actually vaping or electronic cigarettes, e-cigarettes, and some research that was in the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm sure, Bob, you've heard, as have all our listeners, about electronic cigarettes.
Yeah, and it's becoming very fashionable in some circles, and they advertise it particularly to young people to try to get them going. It's another nicotine addiction. I mean, you know, people who take nicotine repeatedly get addicted to it, and they have a hard time giving it up, which is great for sales if you happen to be in the industry.
Well, and we know that a lot of the smokers in our listeners have tried e-cigarettes, and in part they would like to try to get off regular cigarettes. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen as frequently as they perhaps would like, or they continue to smoke cigarettes and use e-cigarettes. And so the question is, are there harms in e-cigarettes? And we don't have a whole lot of data because it'll take 15 years to see this data, but this was research that suggested that one cancer-causing agent found in cigarette smoke can also be in the vaporized, that vapor liquid of electronic or e-cigarettes, and it's called formaldehyde, which most people have heard of. It's the same chemical that's found in embalming fluid.
Right. And, you know, burning vegetation has thousands of bad chemicals in it. This one is the first one I know about that they've managed to isolate from vaping. So is it as bad? Well, we don't know because we've only been having vaping studied for a short period of time. And 20 years from now, we may find 1,000 bad things in that too. But right now, formaldehyde is not good, may be associated with cancer, and probably is yet another reason not to start an addictive habit.
Well, and there are Food and Drug Administration approved medications. And this particular one, in a tank system, when it's the higher the temperature, the more things are released, particularly this product. The last research that matters is just real quickly about a study on stem cells and may they reverse multiple sclerosis disability, a research that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And what they're doing is taking stem cells, giving them to people and hoping they alter their immune system so that the initial phases, the attack phase of multiple sclerosis, it gets interrupted and they get back to normal. Once the damage has occurred, there is no benefit.
And in this study, though, and if you have loved ones with MS, you should probably talk with your doctors. There may well be some benefit. This is some increasing research that I think we're going to be very happy and proud to see over time and if it bears out, because these are one of the great advances, potentially, these stem cells. We've done research. We've done shows on this in the past. Well, Bob, that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had time to talk about these stem cells briefly.
And aspirin. And
the vaping and e-cigarettes. And about research that matters to folks. We'll take a short break. But when we return, we'll be hearing the interview that Dr. Page had with Julia Allen, two-time heart attack survivor and spokeswoman for the American Heart Association, about surviving heart attacks, advocating for your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Koh, resident physician and guest host filling in for Adam today. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we'll be talking with Julia Allen, spokeswoman for the American Heart Association and two-time heart attack survivor, about being your own health advocate.
Yeah, Christy, we are so excited to have Julia join us today. Thank you so much for being a part of our show, Ms. Allen.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we're wondering, you have quite a remarkable story, and you're the spokesperson for the American Heart Association. Wondering if you wouldn't mind telling a little bit about your journey that got you there.
Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, this is probably a spokesperson position most people don't want, because in order to get in this club, you have to have a heart attack or a heart condition. So kind of one of those things I wish I could have bypassed. But, you know, God has a way of turning negative things into positive. So I think, you know, the outcome for this is that I'm having this opportunity to save some lives. I had a heart attack in 2013. Mm-hmm. And after I had the heart attack, I had shared with my physician that I knew I was having a heart attack because of the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women website. And she said, you know, you should share that with them. So I just sent them an email and said, hey, you know, thanks for saving my life. And long story short, I started volunteering with them, and the local office here in Charlotte nominated me to be a Go Red woman, and that's kind of how I got, the short version of how I got to this role.
Wow. Wow. So you took something what sounds like was very difficult and scary and turned it into something that saves other people. That's a remarkable story. We'd love to hear about, if you're willing to share, about what happened that day when you recognized, because of the American Heart Association's program, that you recognized you were having a heart attack.
Absolutely. I was at work, you know, normal day, conference calls and the like, and I started feeling really bad. You know, I felt nausea. I felt like a twisting in my chest, really bad heartburn, but no pain. That's where I want to get out to people. I didn't have pain, and most people think, you know, of like that movie heart attack that you're going to fall out on the floor and have pain, and that didn't happen to me. And so that's why, you know, I missed it. I missed the signs. So initially I ignored it, and then later in the day, the symptoms came back. This time they came back worse, and I had more symptoms. So in addition to what I mentioned earlier, then I had the tightening in my jaw, started having pain down my left arm. I started sweating. It was difficult to breathe. And fortunately for me, the Go Red campaign had just wound up, you know, that prior February. And I remembered seeing a billboard on the highway. And I remembered that women's symptoms were different from men. And so I just Googled it. I'll be honest. I Googled heart attack, wow, symptoms of heart attack in women, and the color red, and the Go Red for Women website came up. That's when I started reading those stories of women who looked just like me, who were my age, and I realized I was having a heart attack.
Like, while you're having a heart attack, you did a Google search. And
I did. I mean, I'm sitting there. See, that's the thing. That is people think, you know, they're going to fall out like you see in the movies, and that's just not necessarily what happens with a heart attack. That happens in cardiac arrest, but not with a heart attack.
Mm-hmm. And just for our listeners, define the difference between a heart attack and a cardiac arrest.
Okay, so I'm not a doctor, but I'm going to try
my
best
here. That's why you're the best one to explain it.
So in my situation, I had a heart attack. Well, that's where I had a blockage. And, you know, you can have a blockage in one or more of your valves. So your heart doesn't necessarily stop working. It's just, you know, it's not doing its best. In cardiac arrest, my understanding is your heart actually stops. In essence, you can die. You're dead. You know, if someone doesn't administer CPR right away, then chances of your surviving that is probably not very good.
Wow. Thank you so much for that explanation. That's great. How did you make it to the hospital then in the end, if you were Googling and realizing you had a heart attack?
Oh, gosh. I'm so embarrassed to tell you guys. I drove myself, which is a huge no-no. And I drove myself because I was still in denial. I still did not believe, even though I read it, that I was having a heart attack. Like, after I read it, I called my husband. And I said, you know, hey, you know, this is kind of what I'm feeling. This is what I saw online. And he's like, you know, what are you doing sitting at work? You should be at the hospital. So we have this back and forth because I don't want to pay the bill. I don't want to sit in the hospital because I'm still believing it's just the flu. So the compromise was that I would call my doctor. I called my doctor's office, and of course she said, absolutely not. Yeah. Go to the hospital. And so that's when I finally relented, and I drove myself to the hospital.
Okay.
So you mentioned just being in denial. You didn't have time. You didn't want that to be the case. What kinds of things have you discovered either were holding you back or hold other people back from seeking care?
I just, you know, my life revolved around taking care of other people, taking care of my kids, taking care of my husband, you know, doing the best job that I could at work. And so I was that person, guys, who never got sick. Like, everybody in my house could have the flu. They could cough, sneeze, and throw up on me. I'm that person. I was that person that never got sick. And I just truly did not believe that my health could have gotten to the point that it had gotten so bad that I could be having a heart attack. I was just in absolute total denial. And so I just thought, you know, this is going to be a waste of time. Why am I going to the hospital? It's, you know, I'm wasting money and I'm wasting my time. My kids are going to get home. They're not going to have dinner prepared. You know, so all of these ridiculous thoughts were actually going through my mind when I should have just taken off and gone to the hospital.
And so you went to the hospital and the doctors tell you you've had a heart attack. Well, that must have hit you hard. And then you were admitted
really
to the hospital, it sounds like.
Say again, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
They kept you in the hospital to monitor
you. Check I was out in there for, what, 4 or 5 days after that, yes.
Okay, and so you must have had some more tests done and some monitoring done during that time?
Absolutely, and then, you know, they change your diet and, you know, you're put on lots of medication and lots of tests.
Yeah. Aside from the tests, did you have any procedures performed to look more closely at your heart?
I did. They did a something catheterization where they go in through your arm.
Yep.
Yeah, and they stick the dye, they push the dye in so that they can see a picture of your heart so that they can actually see where the blockage is. Mm-hmm. And so I had that done, and as it turned out, where my blockage was, it typically when you have a heart attack, they can fix it or they can open the blockage by putting a stent in.
Yeah.
In my case, that could not be done because of where the blockage was. It would not provide enough space for the blood to flow through. And so we were kind of at a standstill. Fortunately for me, I was placed on medication, and that did help to open up that clogged artery. And also new arteries have started to grow out from the blocked one. So I was fortunate.
And so they said they couldn't do the stent procedure, but they had all these new medicines and recommendations for you. I'd love to hear what that was like for you, of what you needed to do now that you knew you'd had a heart attack and had this blockage. You needed to take more medicines, and you mentioned change your diet and these other things. Help us summarize what needed to change in your life going forward to help prevent another heart attack.
Sure. One of the things that we did first was they sent me to cardiac rehab. So that's one of the first things that you do. So I did about a 6-month stint in cardiac rehab, and it was very holistic. You know, they look at your diet, they look at exercise, and you even meet with a counselor to like really look at your life. Like, how did you get to this point? What type of stressors did I have? And really evaluating and trying to come up with a better way to manage my life. Diet was a huge part for me, you know, reducing a lot of the sugars and the salt and the way that I cooked my food, you know. So now we're doing a lot more healthier fruits and vegetables, and I do a lot of baking and broiling and grilling and just really cooking my food for both myself and my family in a much more healthier way.
Well, it sounds like you've made some real steps for your own health and your own heart, and that you're pouring your heart into helping other people. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Julia Allen, spokeswoman for the American Heart Association and 2-time heart attack survivor, about being your own health advocate. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Coe. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Coe, resident physician and guest host, filling in for Adam today. We've been talking with Julia Allen, spokeswoman for the American Heart Association and 2-time heart attack survivor, about being your own health advocate.
Julia, you were just telling us quite a phenomenal story, how you recognized that you were having a heart attack based on some symptoms that you compared with the American Heart Association online, went to the hospital and were treated, and then you were telling us how you were in rehab, learning about new healthy lifestyle modifications, and really about taking control of your own health. Wondering if you wouldn't mind telling us about what that meant to you.
Absolutely. It meant, you know, ladies, it really meant putting myself first. A great example is actually on the way to the hospital, I still could not put myself first. I actually stopped at my house and made a snack and left a note for my kids and said, hey, mommy's going to be home a little late. Here's a snack until
wow.
I get home. I mean, it was that bad for me. You know, here I am in the midst of having a heart attack. And by now, the symptoms had gone away. You know, they came, they went, they came, they went. Mm-hmm. So now I'm thinking, okay, everybody's wrong. I'm right. And I actually stopped at home. You know, before I couldn't even take myself to the hospital. So really, I want to just make a plea out there because I know that there are other moms out there like me. You know, people laugh when I tell them this story, but I've got girlfriends who I know would have done the exact same thing.
And how
we
old
put
were
our
kids
and our families first.
How old were your kids at this point?
Let's see. At this time, they would have been 6, 10, and 4. Wait. 5, 9, and 13.
Wow. So you were a very, very busy mom. And that you would still have such commitment to go home and write them a note first of where you're going.
I said, mommy will be home late, right? I
it's
made
like
them
so
a
snack. Sweet, but not smart. It's so sweet.
Yeah, to that extreme.
I know.
I know it sounds crazy.
Wow. And what else have you learned about being your own health advocate and what that means?
You know, it means everything holistically. It means, you know, looking at even your doctors. You know, for me, after I had the heart attack, you know, I had the cardiologist that I had when I was in the hospital. You know, they just kind of, you just stick with that person typically and they take on your case. But for me, it just wasn't a good match. You know, other than my cardiologist, all my other doctors, I had a really, really good relationship with them. This particular person, you know, his style and my style, they just didn't match up. You know, he would come in, he would look at the computer, he didn't look at me, and we didn't have a conversation. I felt rushed. And so for me, that didn't work. He was a great doctor, probably one of the best in town. But for me, you know, his style and my style didn't match. So as uncomfortable as that was, I had to leave that practice and find another doctor that I felt could meet my needs. And that was someone who could communicate with me, who could look at me and make me feel like a person when I was in the room.
That is so, so important. I mean, you're talking to two family doctors who really value our relationships with patients and how that can transform. And some people connect with, I mean, there's a human interaction there. And
mm-hmm.
so for style and for lots of different factors, people connect with other doctors in different ways. And it's critical to find a doctor, both your primary doctor and your heart doctor in your case, that you can trust and feel connected to and have that respect moving forward.
And how do you think that new relationship has affected your outcome and how your health outlook is these days?
Tremendously, because I feel comfortable asking questions. You know, where with the other doctor, because I felt so rushed, I would leave and half of my questions would go unanswered because I just felt uncomfortable. I can't explain it. It was like I was afraid to speak up. The medications were making me sick. You know, there's a time period in there where they adjust your medications and one may not work and one may work better. And so there's kind of like this game that you play until you get that perfect cocktail. Well, I was suffering because I was uncomfortable sharing with my doctor, you know, every time I take this, it gives me migraines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes me feel sick. I can't get up. I'm nauseous. I wasn't comfortable saying that because I felt rushed. So, you know, you go through two or three appointments before you finally get it out. And so that just was not good.
Well, what happens sometimes is a patient won't tell the doctor in that setting like you have with the first doctor. might not tell the doctor they're not taking the medicine because of the side effects or whatever. And then you're just going through having these doctor visits and nobody actually knows what's happening.
Exactly. And as soon as I spoke up, the medications were changed, and voila, I felt fine. And it was just as simple as having a conversation.
Wow. Well, we applaud you for really speaking up and making sure that your own needs were heard in that situation.
Thank you. Thank you.
What else in terms of being your own health advocate? So, I mean, you had to make a lot of changes and think about your diet and exercise and medications. What else did you learn, or what else is your message to people about how to be their health advocate in the setting of their families and their life?
Right. Well, one of the things that I had to do, you know, was figure out a way to carve in exercise. And one of the things that I did, you know, is I had to really look at my schedule, because, you know, the excuse was, I'm too busy. And I think if we all really sit down and do this, and you look at your schedule and you look at how much time, are you actually wasting? And I looked at my calendar, and although, you know, I had lots of blocks, there was still time in there. So one of the things that I do now is I have a teammate here in my office, and we go for a walk for 30 minutes of our lunch hour every day.
Wow.
You know, so it was small things like that. It was when I'm at track practice or football practice with my boys, instead of sitting on my phone and playing a game or scrolling through Facebook, I take my tennis shoes and some sweats and I walk around the track or the field while they're practicing. So that was just being an advocate for myself, saying, you know what, I'm going to use my time more wisely.
Wow, that is amazing. What a great message. I know it's probably difficult sometimes to remember to take your track pants and your sneakers. What is your motivation to get you up and continue to incorporate that into your daily lifestyle?
Well, you know, it's funny you ask that. It's nothing like a heart attack to make you go for a walk.
Yeah, I guess so.
if nothing else can motivate a person, I think that can. And really, I don't want to go through that again. I don't want to put my family through that again. And, my youngest is 7 years old. I have a reason to live. Mm-hmm. I want to be here and see him graduate from high school and graduate from college and get married and have kids. And I've got a chance to do that now if I make the appropriate changes in my life.
You know, you have a unique voice as someone who's had a heart attack, a woman, an African-American woman, and we know that both women and African-Americans have different outcomes and different symptoms, as you alluded earlier, to heart attacks. How have people responded to you as a spokesperson and the kind of response that you're getting from people?
The response has been very, very favorable. And, you know, on my Facebook page in particular, it's amazing. I get people who, you know, I don't even know, who say, you know, thank you so much for sharing your story. I had this happen to me, or I do the same thing because I read this, you know, I'm going to make some changes. And I'm just so glad you guys asked me from the whole African-American perspective, because one thing that I really would like to just get out there is, you know, the statistics are not good. When you look at African-American women who are ages 20 and older, 48.9%, that's almost half, Christy and Catherine, half cardiovascular disease. So that's mm-hmm. almost 50% of African-American women who are over the age of 20 have cardiovascular disease. That is a number that we really have to change. It really is.
And what do you think is most important for African-American women to know to be able to change that? Just that it is real and they need to pay attention to it? Or what do you recommend to people to get their attention to start taking care of themselves?
You know, for me, a lot of it is culture. For me personally, as an African-American woman, and how I was taught to cook. You know, my father fried food every day. He still does. He's 78 years old, and every day he fries his food. He's not going to change, you know, but that's how I was taught. You know, we fried everything. Mm-hmm. We use a lot of salt and sugar in how we ate. And when I look at the recipes, Go Red for Women, they have a great soul food cookbook who takes a lot of those traditional recipes that we grew up on, and they change how you cook them. It still tastes fabulous, And you can just change by changing and tweaking a few ingredients here and there. You can drastically change some of those numbers, that sodium and sugar and fat that's in our food.
Wow, that sounds really tasty. And it sounds like by cooking those in your house, you're really setting a great example for your children and their future.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely. My kids, it is so ingrained. And then we go to the grocery store, and then I say, you know, go pick out your cereal. And they'll come back, Mom, is this a healthy choice? So for them, it's a lifestyle decision now. It is a lifestyle.
Well, that is an important message to women, to African-American women, to all people, to really think about these lifestyle factors. And we'll put a list on our blog of what those lifestyle elements, exercise and diet and those things that we can change, blood pressure, that we can change to reduce your risk of heart attack, to pay attention to those cultural factors, as you're saying, and to talk to your doctor. Even if you're a young woman, talk to your doctor about your risks of heart disease and what you can do to make it better. Does that
Absolutely.
Sound like a good message?
Anything? Absolutely. You know, one of the things that prevented me from exercising as an African-American was, oh, I don't want to get my hair wet. I don't want to sweat out my hair. Well, guess what? That's not an issue for me anymore. I have a short pixie cut now. I'm wearing my hair naturally curly the way God gave it to me. And, you know, for me personally, I eliminated that excuse from my life of not wanting to sweat or get my hair wet. That excuse is gone. Check that off the list.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are giving such an important message, and what you're doing to have taken a crisis in your life and turned that not just to yourself and for your family and your children and your own health, but then to turn that to help others is just a tremendous story and is certainly serving God well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We appreciate you being with us.
Anyway, I appreciate the interview. I hope we saved some lives today.
I hope so, too.
All right.
We've been talking with Julia Allen, spokeswoman for the American Heart Association and two-time heart attack survivor, about being your own health advocate. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Christy Page and Dr. Catherine Coe.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Dr. Gwaither and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Now we'd like to ask Erica Nouri, our executive producer, to read us our very first House Call question.
My son has a fever, 100.6, and feels pretty warm to the touch. What dose of acetaminophen can I give? Also, are there any alternative medications I should be giving him? And do you have any suggestions for me?
Well, let me start off by saying that a kid with a temperature of 100.6, not 106.
Yes, thank goodness.
is really not a very high fever, and there may be something to the body heating up as a defense mechanism to kill viruses. But if you need to give him something, or you are going to, then acetaminophen is a pretty good choice, 10 to 15 milligrams per kilogram, which is about 20 to 30 milligrams per pound, with a maximum of 150 milligrams a day for a child.
And some parents may prefer to give ibuprofen or children's ibuprofen, but I echo fully, Bob, what you say, which is, a temperature this mild, you might just wipe the child down if the child's uncomfortable with a cool rag, and the evaporation will bring the body temperature down here. Make sure the child's not under 10 blankets or other things that could raise the body temperature.
I got tepid baths, no blankets, and drink plenty of fluids because we don't want them to get dehydrated.
Great answer. Erica, what's our very next house call?
What's the point in getting a flu shot if your coworkers don't? I got the shot just to be on the safe side, and I still got the flu from my coworkers who sit next to me after he came to work when he was sick. Don't you think the flu shot should be mandatory?
Well, you know, we're really kind of the end of flu season now, which has been a pretty difficult flu season. There were a lot of deaths, a lot of illness, a lot of people had the flu. And I think this type of question is increasingly one that we're going to be dealing with, which is the protection you get if no one else around you gets it, and then also mandatory policies that require everyone to get it.
Right. And, you know, no flu vaccine is 100% effective. So you can get it and not manage to avoid the flu. And your coworkers, it's the same thing. And we also have to remember that what people call flu on the street may not be influenza. And we don't have a shot that we're giving people for an ordinary respiratory virus.
This past year, the match, the goodness of that flu vaccine was not very good. So it's very possible that you didn't get as much protection. And then this question about the mandatory. Increasingly, there are policies, particularly at healthcare institutions like the hospital at the University of North Carolina, that if you have patient care contact, you actually have to get a flu shot unless you are allergic to it or you can really document some other reason why you shouldn't get it, because they do want to limit the likelihood that it will get passed on and it can decrease the transmission.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the herd immunity benefits us all.
Yeah. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I'm a 44-year-old who has had high blood pressure on my last few visits to my doctor. The top number has been 160, and the bottom number is usually around 108. I've been told once you begin blood pressure medication, you can never come off. I should also mention I'm trying to lose weight. What are your thoughts?
Well, you can modify blood pressure with other things and medications, no kidding. And it's worth your doctor and you trying to do some things to lose weight, perhaps get a little exercise going, and see what happens. And I also think that even if a physician does start people on medication, that they should be willing to work with them a little bit to see if other things like, say, the DASH diet, which is specifically out there for lowering hypertension, exercise 40 minutes a week, and moderate alcohol intake are three things that you can do to maybe drop your blood pressure straight away.
Yeah, and we should say we are thrilled with the fact that you're trying to lose weight. What a great thing to do. And we're also thrilled that you do follow your blood pressure. I must say, though, in my experience, it's not an either or. You know, waiting until you lose weight to get your blood pressure down could be a long-term process. And we don't know how much you weigh, you know, and you have to lose maybe 10% of your body weight if you're really overweight to make a significant impact on that blood pressure. But it is a big thing you can do. But you might start the medication while you're trying to lose weight, because a blood pressure that you're describing, 160 over 108, is moderately high. This is not a good thing to continue. So sometimes we'll do both things simultaneous. What do you think, Bob?
I think that's the case, and I think we experiment. And we're willing to try to reduce or eliminate drugs if the pressure stays down. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Great question. Erica, what's our very last house call?
I've had a medium-sized knot on my wrist for almost 1 year now. It's gotten slightly bigger over the course of this time, and it's beginning to get in my way, especially when I do yoga. It's firm and round, but not painful. What could this be, and what should I do?
What do you think, Bob?
Well,
we both looked at each other with a little smile on our face.
It sounds altogether like what's called a ganglion cyst, which is a little collection of fluid inside of a synovial membrane pouch. That the wrist is a very busy place for joints, and they're all lined by synovial membranes. And so it's probably a ganglion. And the old adage around here was to take the biggest book in the house and smack it and break it. And
I heard when I was taught, Bob, that they were called Bible cysts.
Right.
Because they would take
often.
The Bible and they would just smash it with the Bible, and then it would be healed because it would be gone.
Yeah. I've seen some people with—
Don't do that. We don't recommend that, by the way.
Right. It was significant injury from that, so I wouldn't do that. I think a physician can take a large bore needle, go in there, introduce it maybe with some anesthetic under it, and pull it out and see if it stays away. If it doesn't, you may have to get a little surgery.
Yeah, these connect to the tendon underneath. So they do have to be a little bit tricky. You have to have a physician that really does know what they're doing, has done a lot of these. And if not, then we recommend, you know, perhaps even see a specialist, an orthopedist. They can occur anywhere on the body. So they do occur a lot on the wrist, but they can occur anywhere on the body. Well, these are great questions, Bob.
Safe to say that could be something else too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll conclude our house calls today. We want to thank you for joining us today for your help. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can send your questions and stories to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, or you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Just search Your Health for a free download.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Julie Allen, and our guest co-host again today. So glad to have you here, Dr. Bob Gwyther. We hope you'll join us again next time on Your Health. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.